and clear.
From the studios of Radio Sputnik in downtown Washington, D.C., it's Loud and Clear. We take you inside the news 5 days a week. It's happening, and it's happening now. I'm John Kiriakou, and I'm joined in studio by co-host Brian Becker. In this hour, we take a look at the breaking news of the day. First, President Trump said in an HBO documentary that will be broadcast on Sunday that he would seek to end birthright citizenship by executive order. Birthright citizenship is automatic American citizenship for any person born in the United States. Apparently, he hasn't bothered to read the 14th Amendment to the Constitution. Next, a judge in Ecuador has ruled against WikiLeaks co-founder Julian Assange, who had contested new rules imposed on him in the country's embassy in London. The judge said a requirement to pay for internet use and to clean up after his cat did not violate his right to asylum. Assange had argued that the conditions violated his fundamental rights and freedoms and were intended to force him to leave the embassy. His lawyers have appealed the ruling. Then, Marina Butina, a Russian graduate student being held without bail for conspiracy to fail to register as a foreign agent, is now being accused of being involved in cyber warfare, according to the Associated Press. The only problem is that Butina wasn't involved in cyber warfare. When she was studying at American University in Washington, one of her professors asked her to gather information on the cyber defenses of U.S. nonprofits for a study he was doing. That's it. And then the New York Times reported yesterday that South Korean President Moon Jae-in is succeeding where all of his predecessors have failed, in engaging North Korea and convincing that country to give up its nuclear weapons program. But the article is not complimentary. It quotes a South Korean newspaper as saying that Moon is Kim's most effective spokesman, and it quotes an American think tank analyst as saying Moon is, quote, a bad moon on the rise, unquote. That's quoting an old Creedence Clearwater Revival song. And finally, Hillary Clinton told an audience in New York a few days ago that she still would like to be president. When asked if she would run again, she said no, paused, said no again, and then said that, well, sure, she'd like to be president. The interviewer says that the public has overreacted to the statement, but Clinton supporters relish the notion of another campaign against Donald Trump. That's all coming up next on Loud and Clear. And now we turn to the issue of birthright citizenship. President Trump said in an HBO documentary that will be broadcast on Sunday that he would seek to end birthright citizenship by executive order. Birthright citizenship is automatic American citizenship for any person born in the United States. Apparently, he hasn't bothered to read the 14th Amendment to the Constitution. We're joined from New York by Juan Carlos Ruiz, co-founder of New Sanctuary Coalition. Welcome back, Juan Carlos.
Thank you. It's good to be here.
Juan Carlos, in this documentary, the president is apparently going to say that he will end birthright citizenship by executive order. The Constitution, however, is very clear. This is an amendment passed in the 1860s in the aftermath of the Civil War. It was meant to try to put the country back together, frankly, after the war.
Before the 14th Amendment, African people who were enslaved mm-hmm. were not citizens.
That's correct.
And so by passing the 14th Amendment in 1868, an amendment that all the southern states and some of the border states also opposed, it gave every person in the United States who was born in the United States automatic citizenship so that it could overcome the earlier legacy where people of African descent who were enslaved were not citizens, they were property. So this was perhaps the most far-reaching, or certainly one of the most far-reaching amendments to the U.S. Constitution. And Juan Carlos, Donald Trump is saying he doesn't need to go through the constitutionally mandated process to amend the U.S. Constitution, which would require two-thirds of the states to pass a change in the amendment, that he's going to do it by executive order. Does he have the legal ability, the legal right, to use executive order to overturn a part of the U.S. Constitution?
Given that history of this amendment, I think there will be opposing forces, and I hope so, because once you give into this kind of craziness, what happens, you know, we enter into a slippery slope where the democracy, the democratic values and pillars are being to be eroded. And we cannot expect anything less from this administration. Right from its beginning, ascending to power, it has been, it's characterized by this bullying quality of basically downplaying or attacking the human dignity not only of minorities and minority groups, but also of citizens. I think we need to really make the connections and sound the alarm, because this is an attack on all people. It's not just our common humanity that is being under attack, but it is really, you know, the whole concept of who is a citizen, who is not. It's being attacked and it's being redefined under racial lines. So we need to really sound the alarm on this.
You know, I'm wondering, too, if Donald Trump did this just to raise the rhetoric in advance of the midterm elections, because even Republicans today, at least Republicans in the House of Representatives, are condemning this idea that he can change this with an executive order. There's a article that's just out in the Hill newspaper quoting Representative Carlos Corbello of Florida, saying that he slammed President Trump over this stated intention to sign an executive order to stop the practice of birthright citizenship. He tweeted, and this is a quote, "Birthright citizenship is protected by the Constitution. So no, Donald Trump, you can't end it by executive order. What we really need is broad immigration reform that makes our country more secure and reaffirms our wonderful tradition as a nation of immigrants." I saw interviews this morning on both CNN and MSNBC with constitutional scholars laughing because Donald Trump thinks that he can change this with an executive order. Juan Carlos, do you see this as something that's just going to go away because it's ridiculous? Or do you think this is going to have to be litigated in the courts?
You know, I hope it just goes away, because I think the political capital that we have nowadays is being wasted. A lot of people, you know, are caught up with this, the caravan. And we have seen how this has played out in terms of the gaining some terrain for the Republicans, you know, in foresight of the voting that is coming up. We do need to, as I said before, not only sound the alarm, but denounce any kind of attempt to overwrite the Constitution. I think, you know, it's the Constitution. If you are a patriot, if you really say that you are a lover of this, that you love this country, we do need to be rising up and basically saying, you know, you cannot do this. Once, if we give into this, I think, you know, thugs, dictators, you know, will have an easier way to utilize the power against us, against the common folk, against this nation. So we have those amendments precisely, you know, because we believe that the Constitution gives us a blueprint in which we can uphold the dignity of every person, you know, of every citizen here on this country, here on this land. So we need to defend that.
Thank you, Juan Carlos. John Kiriakou, there's a couple of ways to amend the Constitution. I think there's really basically two ways that, you know, could be open, available, although only really one has been widely used. But neither of them include an executive order from the President of the United States.
No, it's laughable. The most common way to amend the Constitution, and it's almost impossibly difficult to amend the Constitution, but you have to have a two-thirds vote in the House, a two-thirds vote in the Senate, the President's signature, and then two-thirds votes in the state legislatures of three-quarters of the states. And that's why it takes a decade or two decades to amend the Constitution. And you basically have to have a national consensus for you to be able to get votes like this in three quarters of the states across the country. It's almost impossible. And that's why over the last two generations, we've only seen technical amendments to the Constitution. Things like raising the voting age to 21. I'm sorry, lowering it from 21 to 18. The presidential line of succession. Technical issues.
So that's right.
It's prohibitively difficult.
So then let's assume, Juan Carlos, that if he can't do it by executive order, even if he tries, it'll go immediately to the courts. It's basically a political move. At the same time, Juan Carlos, that he's sending 5,200 military troops to the Mexican border to, quote, stop the caravan to protect America. It seems like everything is political theater. But it's not really theater because at the end of the day, at the end of the performance, Some people are really hurt. Some people are really, really harmed. Go ahead.
That's right. So we talk about political capital here. On this militarized force deploying to the border, they are normalizing such force. And we need to decry this attempt in, you know, with the purpose of gaining the upper hand as we vote in the midterm elections. You know, Solalinde, Father Solalinde, a human rights freedom fighter in Mexico, has decried, you know, that some of these, the caravan is being funded by United States interest groups. And, you know, yeah, to basically, you know, garnish and for the Republicans to get a better grip in terms of the midterm elections, to do better. And the polls are showing that, you know, so we do have to connect the dots here. We need to decry that this is not just an isolated attempt, the deployment of troops, but also this whole political investment on criminalizing this caravan and basically saying, you know, that we are going to do away with the rights of those people, the citizen of those people who are born here from undocumented, so-called illegal parent in the States. That's a very dangerous proposal, and we hope and we decry that this doesn't come to be.
It would also, you know, John, the Republicans and conservatives are always talking about the problem with big government. If you actually created this new this amendment to the Constitution, sure, that would mean every child born in the United States, their parents would have to go through a process to affirmatively prove that they themselves were citizens or were legally present. In other words, it would create new huge layers of bureaucracy. Every child in the United States would have to, who was born here, would have to prove that not only were they born here, but that they had the right to citizenship. And fundamentally, this would overturn the most important, one of the most important, maybe the most important, most far-reaching anti-racist amendments in the U.S. Constitution that overturned the situation in America before 1868, where some people could be declared to be property, mm-hmm, could be declared to be non-citizens simply because of who they are or because of their race or ethnicity. That's what we're looking at.
That's right. And I think we should be prepared to see the country stand together. I think this is a terrible idea. Well, we were happy to be joined from New York by Juan Carlos Ruiz. He's the co-founder of New Sanctuary Coalition. Stay tuned to Loud and Clear. We'll take a short break and we'll come right back.
Loud and Clear.
You're listening to Weekday World on CPR.
Loud and Clear.
Welcome back to Loud and Clear. I'm John Kiriakou.
And I'm Brian Becker.
A judge in Ecuador has ruled against WikiLeaks co-founder Julian Assange, who had contested new rules imposed on him in the country's embassy in London. The judge said a requirement to pay for internet use and clean up after his cat did not violate his right to asylum. Assange had argued that the conditions violated his fundamental rights and freedoms and were intended to force him to leave the embassy. His lawyers have appealed the ruling. We're joined from New York by Randy Credico. Randy is an activist, a comedian, and the former director of the William Moses Kunstler Fund for Racial Justice. Welcome back, Randy.
Gentlemen, it's always a pleasure to be on this show.
Pleasure's ours.
Except for it's always, there's never any good news when I do your show.
Wait, every guest comes on, John, in the last 3 days and says, there's never good news. Oh, it's great to be back with you guys, but it's always because there's bad news on all fronts.
When you guys call, I know there's bad news, okay?
See, and now I'm afraid to segue into the question because I was going to ask you, this isn't about cleaning up after his cat and paying for his internet access, right?
It's what a nasty canard to be throwing out there. Of course it's not about that. Look, I've told you before, I've been to that embassy 3 times, and that, you know, you've seen my dog. His cat is better fed, and I really take care of my dog, as well as my dog. The cat is in great shape, bouncing around in that kitchen area, bouncing around the room where we speak. And the cat is in great shape. So why they throw that in there is real. What are they trying to do? Get PETA to support the expulsion of Assange? It's really such a waste of time to talk about the cat. I'm telling you, let's get that behind us, the cat, all right? It's cat litter from the judge.
There was another thing, too, that I thought was done just to embarrass him. It said that the government of Ecuador was complaining that he didn't clean up after himself in the bathroom and that they're demanding that he keep the bathroom more clean. Good heavens.
He's like Hazel. You remember that TV show Hazel?
Sure.
All right, with Shirley Booth? All right, she cleaned up. That's him. He's, he's anal about it. The place was always immaculate. So the three times I've been, everybody I know who has been there say the guy like is consumed with cleanliness. So I don't know why they throw that out there. You know, really, let's get to the specifics. What is the real reason why they are doing this?
Yes. And especially in light of the fact that the attorney general said that arresting Julian is a priority for the U.S. government. Go ahead.
Yeah, that's it. That's what he says. Yes, he said that a long time ago, and you never know. You know, people should not think. This president has called the press the enemy of the people, all right? And that's like most of the press he's talking about are not the greatest, supporters of Assange. But Assange has been supporters of them, all right? He supported the press. Doesn't matter who they are, he has supported them. And so if they are the enemy of the press, Assange is the enemy of the press. All right, under Trump's definition. And so you have that. You have the attorney general saying he's the highest priority. And you have the former prosecutor from Guantanamo saying that they should hit him with a drone.
Right.
Something like that. You know, so there's no collateral damage. It's like an international. You know, this is like going after Victor Laszlo in Casablanca. You know, he's the most dangerous guy in the world.
Yeah. Randy Credico is our guest. Randy is an activist. He's a comedian.
Not so funny these days, but go ahead.
You are funny, Randy, but you're upset.
Victor Laszlo.
Yeah.
Yes.
But Randy, what comes next, on all seriousness, what comes next for Julian Assange? Again, for our audience, they're bringing up all these, as we put it, canards to try to defame, demonize, caricature Julian Assange. Julian Assange has been held, according to the United Nations ruling, in arbitrary detention for more than 5 years. I mean, each and every one of us should imagine what that means. And what's his crime? His crime is that he revealed, and WikiLeaks revealed under his editorship, hundreds of thousands of documents that told the truth about what the U.S. was doing in Iraq, what governments were doing all around the world, information that actually was keenly important for people to be informed.
Yep.
You can't have so-called democracy with an uninformed population. And that's why governments don't want to inform people. Everything we get, the people, are like sound bites or the kind of, echo chamber that the mass media functions as, representing U.S. government or the government's position, whatever country you're in. Here, Julian Assange did something different. That's why the United States and the UK is after him. So this is an epic battle. It's all important. At the very moment that Julian is have all this pressure put on him, alternative media is being squeezed all over the United States and certainly all over the UK under different guises. What comes next, Randy Credico?
Well, what comes next is you got to just continue fighting until, last man goes. I mean, that's where we are right now. It seems like they are squeezing alternative forms of information and alternative press. They really are. And there's a concerted effort. They want to put the genie back in the bottle. It may be too late for that, I think. I mean, but as far as Julian Assange goes, you mentioned the war logs and how important those war logs were so we had a better understanding of what we were doing in Iraq and Afghanistan. And, he also exposed stuff in Saudi Arabia, and you can see what's happening in Saudi Arabia, what they did to Khashoggi in that embassy. They're doing to him in the Ecuadorian embassy, all right, without chopping him up. Instead of chopping him up, it's death by a thousand cuts here. They want to squeeze, they want to push him out of there somehow, make the conditions so bad, and that's not working because he's a man that's resilient, he's resourceful, he's got the kind of will that you rarely see in a human being. and he's been able to do it. He's got this major role in history. He is now, as he is, he's alive, but he is really has reached, and I said this last thing I was on your show, a martyr type of status while he's alive. And all it is doing is gathering a storm of support for him. That's all this is doing at this point. So the government of the UK, which is really behind this and this extraordinary rendition of Assange inside the Ecuadorian embassy, they're involved. They're in cahoots with the Saudis, so they're involved. The conspiracy in the murder of those children in Yemen and the mass murder in Yemen and other places. That's what's going on in the UK. They got so much dirt. They got so much dirty laundry, the UK. They're the ones that should be investigating themselves. I said the last time, Tony Blair and Jack Straw, they should be investigated. And in fact, the majority of the people in England, in Great Britain, think that these guys have a price to pay for lying and getting the UK involved in the annexation of Iraq in 2003.
Randy, I want to ask you, too, do you have a sense at all of what the Ecuadorian government intends over the long term? It seems like with this new government of Lenin Moreno, they are more short of temper with Julian and that they want to push him out. Do you see it coming to something like that?
Well, they're trying every way without deliberately pushing him out. They're, like I said, it's what's next? They're going to like put tear gas in there and say, well, we didn't push him out. Let's just throw some tear gas in there so he has to come out. You know what I mean? Without just physically removing him, they're making the conditions and they keep upping it and upping it and upping it, making it more difficult. They, of course, they want him to walk out. I understand that in August, there was a guarantee by the British government that they would not allow Assange to be extradited. I hope that's true, but I don't believe it. You got to be skeptical of that. And what is it that they want? It's for not even, you can't even call it bail jumping, because the superseding crime here wasn't a crime. It was an investigation that was dropped. There was never any charge against Assange coming out of Sweden. There was never a charge. The UK government kept that phony investigation going for 5 years when they wanted to throw it out in 2012. They said, there's nothing here. Let's throw it out. But the British government, the Crown Prosecutor Services, they instigated this. They have collaborated, they have instigated a phony investigation of Julian Assange, and they kept him there. They should pay a price for this. I mean, he does have, in fact, the UN Office on Arbitrary Detention says he is right now should be free, and he should be compensated for what they've done to him. This is 6 years plus, 6 years and what, 5 months he's been in this position inside that embassy, and then 7 months isolated and not allowed to have friends in there. And now they've upped the conditions on the medical part, on the internet. They really are just trying to push him out of there. That's what the Ecuadorian government is doing. And is it his real position? Obviously, Lenin Moreno is being squeezed to death by the U.S. government and the U.K. governments.
That's the voice of Randy Credico. John, as we go out here, and I know we are out of time, the Iraq war logs that Julian Assange and WikiLeaks released included the videotaped footage from an Apache attack helicopter flown by a U.S. pilot that shows the gunning down of a Reuters journalist, a photojournalist, and many other civilians, Iraqis, in cold blood during the Iraq war. Reuters knew about the fact that this footage existed. It was their journalist who died. They had FOIA'd. They put in public records requests to the Pentagon. The Pentagon, they knew, had the videotape. The Pentagon didn't release the videotape because it showed that this was a crime.
It was a war crime.
It was a war crime, and they weren't going to prosecute anybody. So WikiLeaks released that. It had a huge impact. The reason it had a huge impact is people want to know about stuff like that. They want to know if the government that speaks in their name is carrying out war crimes.
And they have a right to know.
And so Reuters couldn't get it. They're a media source. Everybody says Reuters, Reuters, Reuters. It's a credible media source. WikiLeaks did the job. They got the job done. They released it. and now Julian Assange is held in arbitrary detention. People have to remember those kind of facts when they think about what's at stake.
And that's why we need WikiLeaks. We're going to have to end it there. We were joined from New York by our friend Randy Credico. Randy is an activist, a comedian, and the former director of the William Moses Kunstler Fund for Racial Justice. Stay tuned to Loud and Clear. We'll take a short break and come right back.
Loud and Clear.
You're listening to Weekday World on CPR.
Loud and Clear.
Welcome back to Loud and Clear. I'm John Kiriakou.
And I'm Brian Becker.
Maria Butina, the Russian graduate student being held without bail for conspiracy to fail to register as a foreign agent, is now being accused of being involved in cyber warfare, according to the Associated Press. The only problem is that Butina was not involved in cyber warfare. When she was studying at American University in Washington, one of her professors asked her to gather information on the cyber defenses of U.S. nonprofit organizations for a study that he was doing. That's it. We're joined from New York by Jim Cavanaugh. He's the editor-in-chief of thepolemicist.net. Welcome back, Jim.
Thanks for having me.
Jim, Brian and I have really parsed this this AP article, and the headline, "Russian held as agent studied U.S. group cyber defenses," is not a fair headline. That's really not what happened. Talk about this a little bit.
Well, yeah, it seems to me that what she was doing was the research work her professor asked her to do. And that involved asking human rights groups or this internews agency particularly about security problems, general cybersecurity problems. It didn't seem to me that she was getting particular algorithms or programs. She was asking them general questions about how they dealt with issues of cybersecurity. And this has been blown up into this spy thriller that, you know, she was, I don't know what they think she was trying to do here. Oh, she was going to, by doing this, she was going to get, enable the Russian government to torture and kill human rights activists. And this really, there's nothing in the article or in the details of it that supports this. It's just a lot of speculation and may have, and she may be, and this and that. So it's, again, this woman, you know, this is anybody who comes from a foreign country who studies in the United States now is under threat of being accused of being an agent for that country and being put in jail if they don't acknowledge it. That's crazy.
She's the victim. I believe she is the victim of a terrible injustice. The fact that she has no bail, I don't know if she's still in solitary confinement, but she was. Part of the argument of the prosecutor about why she shouldn't have bail is that the Russian government, through its embassy, sought to inquire about her conditions, which
right.
is
totally normal consular activity of an embassy.
Like if you're an American, you get arrested somewhere else, you call the American consulate, they come. But because the Russian government did what all governments are obligated to do for its citizens when they're in custody in another country, that was the example used by the prosecutor for why this woman, this young woman, should not receive bail. I mean, she's being held now. She was arrested July 15th. So now we're in 3.5 months. A bunch of that was in solitary confinement. And, you know, I want to read a little bit from the AP story, if I could, Jim, and just ask you to comment then. Because it mixes and matches and uses words in a way that helps people come to a conclusion that the facts of the article actually don't substantiate. Butina participated in the project under the tutelage of a respected professor who advised the State Department on cybersecurity matters. It was carried out for the nonprofit group Internews, which works extensively with the U.S. government to bolster the free flow of information in dangerous parts of the world and has drawn Russian ire with some of its programs in Russia and neighboring countries. The group also advises other nonprofits on cybersecurity. Internews confirmed Butina's involvement and a broad description of what the project involved. A lawyer for Butina did not respond. Now, first of all, who is Internews? You know who Internews is? It is the U.S. government. It really is an intelligence organization because 99.98% of its funding comes either from the State Department or USAID, Agency for International Development, which, John Kiriakou, you know, it seems to me, I know as a former CIA officer, I don't even want to ask you your comments, but a lot of people have come to the conclusion over a long time that USAID is an organization, while doing relief work, especially in other parts of the world, the third world, so to speak, that it works closely with U.S. intelligence agencies. I don't need you to comment.
That's okay. That's long been a rumor.
It's been a rumor.
Yep. And, you know, it's been proven that the CIA used the media, Operation Mockingbird. And
Operation Mockingbird. That's right.
And used nonprofit organizations. And in fact, that's one of the interesting things about the AP thing. If you read it, you realize it's all about American influence peddling operations.
Oh, indeed.
It says right here, the U.S. runs multiple programs aimed at strengthening democracy and boosting pro-Western sentiment in Russia's backyard and in parts of the world where America and Russia are vying for influence.
It's an American meddling operation in Russia and 69 other countries.
So this is, you know, Americans are pushing their line through their vehicles and the Russians are pushing their line through their vehicles, and that's par for the course. But there's no indication that she, this woman, Maria Butina, was working for the Russian government. And it says AP found no evidence that Butina passed any information from the University Project to Moscow.
That's a quote.
That's a quote from the article.
But you have to get way deep in the article where you find out, guess what? Nobody says she actually passed any information to the Russian government.
But the work allowed her to contact likely Russian targets. So again, it's all of this could have, would have allowed, open the door for, you know, and for this reason, as you say, she's been in jail, until September in solitary confinement, which is crazy. And they use the fact that Russian consul officials visited her as proof that she was working for the Russian government.
Let me interrupt you, Jim. I've done rotations at the State Department where I was actually on loan to the State Department for a number of years. And in that capacity, I was a consular officer. I'm actually like certified as a State Department consular officer. I have the certificate signed by Bill Clinton to prove it. But it was my job to go to jails around the country, whether it was in Greece or in Bahrain, two of the places that I served, to ask Americans who have been arrested, are you okay? Is there anything I can do? Do you want me to call your folks? Make a recommendation for an attorney. Now, in Bahrain, the idea was the Bahrainis would call and they'd say, hey, we arrested this American. Get him the hell out of here. And you'd go to the jail. You'd pick the guy up. You'd drive him to the airport and put him on the next plane. In other countries, you just want to check on their welfare, see what they're doing. Well, same thing between the United States and Russia. You go, normal part of your duties to make sure that your citizen is okay, that the citizen is being treated well, the citizen has access to an attorney, and their human rights are being respected. Frankly, because I believe that this whole situation is a trumped up political charge, I'm surprised that the Russians haven't snatched an American graduate student in Russia to file a charge of conspiring to fail to register as a representative of a foreign government or another nonsensical charge.
And that's what she's charged with, which is a nonsensical charge. Conspiracy to fail to register.
As a representative of a foreign government. And the Russians haven't done that. And that tells me that it's the Russians that are more patient. It's the Russians that have a longer term view on this issue.
Or just maybe the Putin government is concerned about any escalation. Even if they retaliate, it'll be treated as a form of unilatural aggression.
Yeah, it probably will. At least in the U.S. press, it would.
This sets an example, not just Russia. Iran could do the same thing. And they could say, oh, look, the American consul came and visited him twice. That means he is a Russian agent.
See? Exactly.
He's an American agent. He's an agent of the American government.
And there are a couple of other things that were written in this article that we have to bring up. This is another quote. This is from the State Department spokesman. He says, we have verified that all documents InterNews provided to its students were publicly available, and we remain confident in the integrity of the State Department's programs with InterNews. Publicly available information.
Okay, and then let's go back to the headline. Russian held as agent studied U.S. group's cyber defenses. In fact, John, what you're saying is what she studied and what the other students who were given this assignment from the professor studied are actually, you could go to the library and look them up.
Precisely. It's as simple as that.
And a professor vouched for it, too. The professor, who is someone who has high security clearance.
That's right.
He vouched and said, I've always observed university policies and rules, and it was, you know, she was given no information that wasn't.
You know, let's expand on that for a sec. We have less than a minute left, Jim, but this professor is not stupid. This professor is somebody who has worked with the U.S. government for many years. He's had multiple contracts with the U.S. government. He has a security clearance. He's not just going to open up a sensitive issue, hand it to a Russian graduate student,
yeah,
knowing that there's potentially classified information. That doesn't make any kind of sense at all.
And the Internews organization, again, 99.98% of its funding comes from the State Department or USAID. They say that the students, including Butina, were never given access to the group's work or systems. So what is this? This is like a planted story.
It is. It's propaganda.
Convict Maria Butina in the media.
One of the reasons why is because their charge against her about her being a honeypot trying to have, you know, lure people with sex collapsed.
Yeah, they had to apologize for that.
That threatened their case. So now they're coming out with something else. They're trying to push something else in, which makes her look evil and Mata Hari. And
yeah.
So that this is a compensation for that, I think.
Yeah, and she should be compensated. That was a sexist, completely fabricated sexist attack. This whole honeypot allegation that collapsed, and now she's a grad student with an assignment, again, with publicly available information, but again, the media is convicting her. This is an injustice. Maria Butina should actually be given bail. She should be set free. She should be able to face her accusers.
Agreed. We're going to have to leave it there, though, guys. We were joined from New York by Jim Kavanaugh. Jim is the editor of thepolemicist.net. Stay tuned to Loud and Clear. We'll be right back.
Loud and Clear.
You're listening to Weekday World on CPR.
Loud and Clear.
Welcome back to Loud and Clear. I'm Brian Becker.
And I'm John Kiriakou.
The New York Times reported today that South Korean President Moon Jae-in is succeeding where all of his predecessors have failed in engaging the leadership of the DPRK, North Korea, and convincing that country to give up its nuclear weapons program. But the article isn't complimentary. It quotes a South Korean newspaper as saying that Moon is Kim's most effective spokesman, meaning he's the spokesman for North Korea. And it quotes an American think tank analyst saying Moon is, quote, a bad moon on the rise, quoting an old Creedence Clearwater Revival song. We're joined from Seattle by Simone Chun. Simone is a fellow at the Korea Policy Institute and a member of the Korean Peace Network. Professor Simone Chun, welcome back to Loud and Clear.
Thanks for inviting me. Nice to be back.
Thank you for joining us. I have to tell you, I was a little bit disgusted, trying to find the right word. Disgusted is the word I'm going to opt for, with the headline and the content of this New York Times article that came out October 29th, yesterday. The headline is, South Korea's leader vouches for Kim's sincerity as critics see deception. And Kim, of course, is Kim Jong-un. And then it's a picture of Kim Jong-un, the leader of North Korea, and Moon Jae-in, the president of South Korea, walking together during a visit in North Korea by a river. And it makes it look like they're really, like they're good friends. And what it's really suggesting, this article is suggesting, is that Kim Jong-un is either manipulating Moon Jae-in, or Moon Jae-in is sort of the unwitting fool falling for the deception. They even in the article describe, in a way, they describe Moon Jae-in as the agent of North Korea. Here we have the New York Times, the quote, liberal New York Times. It seems to me that this article, which comes across or is purportedly a news article, is a very carefully crafted editorial position designed to sabotage Moon Jae-in's efforts to bring about peace on the Korean Peninsula. Anyway, what's your thoughts?
Yes, indeed, it is a shame on New York Times giving a platform for the very ultra-right wing and the minority voice who are afraid of a Korean peace process and who, as you pointed out, trying to sabotage the current peace talk. And I did read the article this morning, and the two sources that New York Times cites is one is the Joseon Ilbo, that is one of the right-wing newspaper in Korea. And according to the recent poll, is the least trusted media. So you can see where the, you know, about the source. And the other source that you can see, the New York Times site is called the, what he was referring to, Gordon Chang, who is a notorious right-wing the pundit who is day after day, he's having the rant against President Moon. So he was saying that bad moon rise. And so based on these two sources, I think that there isn't much of a credibility on this particular article. Then again, it just was such a shame. With regard to President Moon, the image they create, President Moon somehow is becoming spokesperson for Chairman Kim. Let us point out the fact that more than 80% of Korean people welcomed this proposal, especially about the prospect of Chairman Kim's visit to South Korea. Again, say that 80%, more than 80% of Koreans. And also, majority of Korean people, 9 out of 10 Koreans in recent polls support the Korean peace process. So it is not, I would argue that in response to that I would argue that it's Korean people who are behind this peace process. It's not just the President Moon Jae-in. President Moon Jae-in is actually spokesperson for Koreans who support democracy and peace. And I think the big picture here you see here is also the growing sort of a orchestrated chorus of America's right-wing think tanks, and such as Heritage Foundation, CSIS, and RAND Corporation, in conjunction with the very minority voice in South Korea, who are right now in the process of sabotaging and trying to discredit President Moon. And so I think it is very important that we should, as your media is doing, to respond to this horrendous alleged and claim.
Well, that actually raises a question for me. I'm not a Korea expert, as the two of you are. But if this peace plan between the two Koreas has the support of 90%+ of the South Korean people and is going so well for Donald Trump, a conservative or pseudo-conservative Republican president, why would an outlet like the New York Times place an article like this? Brian, I agree with you. I think this article was placed. This is not news. I think this is a propaganda piece that found its way into the New York Times. Did it come from one of these American think tanks, American Enterprise Institute, the Heritage Foundation, CSIS? If it didn't, who would be behind it? Simone, would you have any idea?
I don't think that it is. I wouldn't say in a conspiracy theory. By the way, the author of the reporter who wrote this article is actually Korean. He was actually a very respected Korean. But for the last few years or so, when it comes to foreign policy, he has taken very conservative viewpoint. And again, short time that I had this morning to prepare for this interview, I checked all the sources. Most of the sources that he's citing are from those conservative think tanks. So I think he's well aligned with working with those, becoming a voice for those conservative voices. But I think that we should actually point it out, though, this is still, again, minority voice. And one more thing I want to point out is, as I recall, New York Times has not always been, when it comes to foreign policy, I mean, even from 1980s and, the issues in Central America, and New York Times has often been very taking sort of a conservative position in foreign policy. So I think this is pretty much established interest groups within the United States. And New York Times, although it's not, said as liberal, but it's always often protecting this established news and industrial complex and this right-wing interest group. But nevertheless, the one thing that we need to point it out, but just last week, as you guys know, that there has been a historic attempt to really demilitarize the DMZ, as you recall, that two Koreas and UNC agreed to disarm the joint security area. And no matter what right-wing pundits are spinning out, I think two Koreas are very determined. They're going step by step. It is action that matters, not the words and all the Twitter and even including the New York Times propaganda.
Yeah. And again, I'm going to really quickly quote for the audience here what the New York Times article says. If Mr. Kim, just check out these words. If Mr. Kim wanted to change his image from nuclear madman to mature negotiator, it's unlikely he could have found a better agent than Mr. Moon, the president of South Korea. Now, first of all, the New York Times, this is so disingenuous. How did he, quote, get the image of nuclear madman? That's not probably how the North Korean people feel. That's probably not how most people in the world feel. That's what Donald Trump was calling Kim Jong-un a year and a half ago or a year ago. And the New York Times was deriding Donald Trump for being so provocative. And then Donald Trump changed as the two Koreas took the initiative for this peace initiative. Donald Trump said, yeah, I want to put my name to it. He wants to be part of what may be a historic breakthrough in the Korean Peninsula for whatever reason, for his own reasons. And suddenly then the New York Times associates his, quote, Kim Jong-un's image as a nuclear madman as if it just came from nowhere or it was universally accepted rather than the fact that it was indeed Donald Trump's formulation. So I think what's actually going on is that the New York Times, representing the military-industrial complex and the neocon establishment and neocon policies, are no longer Republicans. It's a consensus position. They want to sabotage this peace agreement. And Professor Chun, the two Koreas know this, and both Koreas are racing to take practical measures to keep the momentum going. So I'm looking at the Japan Times. Guns to the Koreas to take guns out of Cold War truce village. That's what you're talking about. Demilitarizing the DMZ, demilitarizing the demilitarized zone, which is really the most militarized part of the planet. Both of those leaders in Korea know that they're facing stiff headwinds. They have to do dramatic things like demilitarizing the DMZ to keep things on track, right? I mean, that's really what's going on.
Exactly. You know, referring to this recent accomplishment, demilitarizing DMZ. You know, two of my nephews served in the DMZ in the Bora area, and I just spoke to them, and they said, you know, yesterday, you know, it's truly, truly historic, and nobody knows what it's like to be there. You know, it is indeed the scariest place and the most, heightened tension, and the Koreans know that, you know, all of our, you know, brothers and fathers and with sons and grand and our sons are serving in the military, and we know what it's like. And we just we are sick and tired of this state of war. We want to end the war. That's what we are going to do. I think no matter what New York Times say, I think that's what the two Koreas are going to stick to it. And I think that instead of all what happened, let's just celebrate the amazing accomplishment that was made by two Koreas. And thank you very much, I think, again, for your support and calling attention to this very idiotic punditry.
Yes, we're going to have to leave it there. But I was also at the DMZ a couple times. I was on the northern side. You are totally right, Professor Chun. If you haven't been there, you can't possibly imagine. You're literally feet away from two armies facing each other, guns pointed. The level of tension was so great. If this could happen, if the DMZ could be demilitarized for real, it's a historic achievement almost like none other. Anyway, that was the voice of Professor Simone Chun. She's a fellow at the Korea Policy Institute. She is a member of the Korean Peace Network. You're listening to Loud and Clear. Stay with us.
Loud and Clear.
You're listening to Weekday World on CPR.
Loud and Clear.
Welcome back to Loud and Clear. I'm John Kiriakou.
And I'm Brian Becker.
We are 1 week away from the midterm elections, so today we'll look at how an offhand comment may affect those elections. Hillary Clinton told an audience in New York a few days ago that she would still like to be president. When asked if she would run again, she said no, paused, said no again, and then said that, well, she'd like to be president. The interviewer says that the public has overreacted to that statement, but Clinton's supporters relish the notion of another campaign against Donald Trump. We're joined here in the studio by Walter Smolarek. He is one of the producers of this show and a Sputnik News analyst. Walter, I read this article and then I read it a second time. It was in the New York Times, and I don't see what all the big deal is. Hillary did not say she was going to run for president. She did not say she was thinking of running for president. What she said was that she would like to be president, which is a secret to literally no one on the planet, because she has the experience, which she then outlined, and she has the ideas necessary to solve some of the country's problems. So why are people making such a big deal at the idea of Hillary Clinton running for president when there are at least 20 other Democrats who are also thinking of running for president.
Yeah, there's two interpretations you can have of this. I mean, one, which is like very reasonable, what you just laid out, that this is actually not that big of a deal. But there's also, I mean, not to say that I necessarily agree with this, but just to lay out how somebody could read this differently. You know, Hillary Clinton, as you said, you know, has obvious political ambitions and has for her whole life. You know, it's not unthinkable that she could become the, you know, that she could run for president in 2020. And so she might want to throw up some trial balloons, like say, OK, let me just sort of tease the idea. She knows that, you know, the different media outlets will make headlines out of this because it's, you know, it's something that'll get clicks or reads or whatever. And so then, based on that reaction, she can sort of, you know, make a calculation about whether or not to proceed. A major criticism of her during the 2016 election is that she basically felt that she was owed it, that it was like a coronation rather than like a true democratic process. And so this is a way, by phrasing it like that, that, you know, oh, well, I don't have any desire to run, but, you know, I would be good. And here's the reasons why. Maybe. Just maybe she's sort of laying the very formative groundwork of it.
There are, as I said, a whole bunch of Democrats considering a run for president. Politico has a piece today talking about the six, as things stand at this very, very early stage, the six most important Democrats running. They're calling it six Democrats leading the 2020 media primary. With the point being, if the media doesn't take you seriously as a candidate, you're not going to be taken seriously by the electorate, and you don't have a prayer. We saw that happen just 2 years ago with, you know, three quarters of the Republicans running for president. Anyway, they're saying that the serious ones so far are Bernie Sanders, 17% in the polls, Joe Biden at 12%, Michael Avenatti, Stormy Daniels' attorney, at 12%, and we can agree to disagree on the seriousness of Michael Avenatti. Elizabeth
serious,
Warren.
Definitely serious.
Definitely not. Elizabeth Warren at 11%, Kamala Harris at 8%, and Cory Booker at 8%. Now, there are other candidates here, but none of them go over 5%. That's Beto O'Rourke, Amy Klobuchar, both at 5%, John Kerry at 4%. I'm going to stifle a laugh on that one. Kirsten Gillibrand at 4%, Mike Bloomberg at 3%, although he's got like $50 billion of his own money that he could spend on such a race and become a serious candidate. Eric Holder, who's a joke, at 3%, and Eric Garcetti, the mayor of Los Angeles, at 2%. So why would Hillary jump into something like this if she's going to face all these fresh faces with new ideas and plenty of money?
Sure. Yeah, I don't think that she would do well, but also, I mean, she could really only succeed in an extremely crowded field, right? I mean, in the 2016 Democratic primary, there was her and Bernie Sanders and some people like Lincoln Chafee and people who are just like completely not serious. Jim Webb was the other guy.
That's an important point right there, because Hillary really didn't have opposition last time. Lincoln Chafee, please. I mean, the only reason he was even a senator is because his dad was a senator and died, and Lincoln was able to convince the governor to appoint him to his dad's seat, which he then promptly lost on his own. And Jim Webb and some former governor of Maryland. I don't even remember who.
Well, there was Bernie Sanders.
Well, besides Bernie, and the election, of course, was stolen from Bernie.
Yeah, I mean,
well, that's what we're saying. Yeah, that's what we mean, right? That there's, you know, the in a field like that, it's easy for opposition to coalesce around a single candidate.
Yeah,
yeah. I think the bigger question they should have followed up when she said, "I'd like to be president, but I don't want to run again," which would require her to just be anointed, which is what
right.
she
that's
sort
what
of
she
assumed
thought was going to happen.
I think the follow up question should be, "Do you think you'd go to Wisconsin?"
Yeah,
because, imagine. Of course, she lost Wisconsin by 23,000 votes. She blamed the Russians, Putin, the tremendous Russian operation in Wisconsin, but she never visited Wisconsin.
You know, I think I've told you on this show before. If I haven't, I'm going to repeat myself. But I happened to be in Michigan just in the days before the campaign, and I saw, for the very first time, I saw a Trump advertisement. And I thought to myself, does Trump actually think he can win Michigan? Like, why would he be wasting his money in Michigan? There's no chance he's going to beat Clinton in Michigan. Of course, he did. He beat her in Michigan. He beat her in Wisconsin. He beat her in Iowa and Pennsylvania and Ohio and Florida and everywhere else that Hillary didn't bother to campaign in because she thought it was a gimme.
Yeah. And here's the other thing is that Hillary Clinton, she won the popular vote. Let's
she
not
did,
forget.
By 2.9 million votes.
2.9? I thought it was 3 point something.
No, I just saw it this morning on MSNBC.
Okay. So you use MSNBC as a credible news source?
I admit that I do watch Morning Joe every day.
Okay. All right. Well, that doesn't attest to its credibility. But that said, she did win. She won the popular vote. The anachronistic Electoral College is the reason she's not the president right now. The Democrats, instead of denouncing the slave-based Electoral College, decided to blame Putin instead for the inexplicable, meaning Hillary Clinton lost to the most unpopular politician in American history, Donald J. Trump. But the other problem is not just that Hillary Clinton has been here before. She proved over and over again, but especially in 2016, that her message, which is so tied to and connected to the Wall Street banks, to corporate capitalism, to neoliberal capitalist policies.
The military-industrial complex.
The military-industrial complex, constant wars. It does not actually resonate in working-class communities which are required to win those battleground states. That's her fundamental problem. It's not even that she's done it before, she's lost, and she lost to Barack Obama and then lost to Donald Trump. It's her message is the message of the sort of corporate banking elites. And none of that has changed. That's the same Hillary Clinton.
Yeah, that's absolutely true. And, you know, I think that it's entirely foreseeable that even if Hillary Clinton, the individual, is not the nominee in 2016, that whoever the Democratic nominee will make the same fundamental mistake. Because I think that, you know, it's not just a question of messaging and optics. I think it's a fundamental question of loyalty.
Yeah, it's not even a mistake. It's who they are.
Yeah, yeah. You know, let's just think about it. In 2009 and 2010, I mean, the favorite Democratic Party excuse why they don't do, you know, these big progressive promises that they talk about on the campaign trail is, oh, well, the Republicans are obstructing us. Or now that, you know, they've won the presidency, well, hey, you know, you just vote for us in 2020, then maybe we can make these things happen. But in 2009 and 2010, they had Barack Obama was just elected the president. He was extremely popular. They had control of the House of Representatives and the Senate, and they could have done effectively anything they wanted. One instance is the Employee Free Choice Act, you know, something that I would admit have made it much, much easier to organize a union in the United States, would have injected a historic boost of energy to the labor movement. Barack Obama promised to, you know, support and, you know, shepherd through the passage of the Employee Free Choice Act. And what did they do when they got into office? They never even talked about it again. It was outrageous.
Yeah. And that would have changed the balance of forces in 2016, because truthfully, millions of workers who want to be in unions would sign union cards if they have the majority of union cards under that bill as it was constructed or would have been constructed. That would have meant that they had a union, that they didn't have to go through the long, agonizing National Labor Relations Board so-called election system, which is really just a way for bosses to beat down workers, especially low-paid workers, intimidate them, scare them, let them know that if they vote union, they're going to either lose their job or maybe the entire enterprise will go somewhere else. I mean, that would have changed the balance of forces, and that Obama did not do. And shame on the labor leadership that gave Obama and the Democrats so much money, and at the end of the day, did not hold Obama accountable. So, yeah, the Obama administration and Obama and Clinton and the Democrats, they take working class people and their organizations, the unions, for granted.
Absolutely true. And I think that it's something that, you know, we saw manifest in the Fight for 15, right? That was something that I think was basically a different approach, something that was very hopeful in my mind, something that involved the mobilization of masses of unorganized workers. You know, this was not sort of a done in direct opposition to the Democratic Party, but I think it was something that was substantially different than the failed strategy that some labor unions pursue, where it's basically all about donations to candidates. And so, you know, we see another wave for the labor movement through the Fight for 15, through the teacher strikes that took place across the country. You know, maybe we can see the sort of shoots of the emergence of a new fighting labor movement or a rejuvenated fighting labor movement.
Well, the question is, are the Democrats going to stick to these issues or are they going to campaign on personalities? Because a personality-based campaign never works in the long run.
Or just campaigning and say, guess what, we're not Donald Trump.
And that's also not a platform. Well, you've been listening to Loud and Clear. We are completely out of time. Be sure to go to our Facebook page, Loud and Clear with Brian Becker, for daily updates. If you enjoy the show and want your friends to hear it, let us know by liking the page on Facebook, and you can follow us on Twitter at Loud Clear Radio. You can also hear us every day, Monday through Friday, from 4 to 6 p.m. on 105.5 FM and 1390 AM in the Washington, D.C. area. You can hear us at sputniknews.com and as a podcast at iTunes, iHeartRadio, Spreaker, and Spotify. Remember, telling the truth is important, but to make a difference, it has to be loud and clear. See you next time.
Loud and clear.